My Classic Album with Mike Norris is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of My Classic Album and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.
It's just like a wall of awesomeness coming at you. That's how I would describe the whole album.
It's just been a lot of fun for me, Mike, to talk with you about this album at this moment.
It's something that everybody should hear at least once in their life.
It's fucking amazing!
You're listening to My Classic Album with Mike Norris.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of My Classic Album. As always, looking back on some of the greatest albums in music history, I'm Mike Norris. Thank you for joining me for another episode of the show, and thank you to everyone who's joined us over the last month. February was a really busy month. It might only have been 28 days in the month, but we managed to get three episodes out in that time, which might not seem like a lot compared to some podcasts, but the amount of work that goes into one episode of My Classic Album, it was a huge undertaking to get three out, but three fantastic episodes that I thoroughly recommend that you check out if you get an opportunity. You know, looking at the likes of Frank Zappa's Joe's Garage, My Chemical Romance's The Black Parade, Neil Young's After the Gold Rush. So three very different albums, but all fantastic, all worthy of their place among our kind of pantheon now of classic albums. So I'd like to absolutely send my thanks to Troy Redfern, The Warning, and Jack J. Hutchinson for choosing those albums to celebrate on the show. We've got another album more than worthy of the mantle of classic album today. We're finally doing a Toto album. Nearly 6 years and someone's finally chosen a Toto album. I'm losing my shit. I'm officially excited. Lizzie Hayes from The Hot Damn is joining me in just a few minutes. And you know what it is? She's picked arguably, and I say arguably because it's tough and you'll hear that in our conversation, arguably the best Toto album as well in Toto 4. So absolutely, you know, sit back, enjoy our conversation in just a few minutes if you're a Toto fan. You know, it's absolutely an episode that you're hopefully really, really going to enjoy. And I guess the classic albums just keep coming. You know, we've got some great episodes in the next month or so. So 2 weeks from today, we're going to have Fred Hale and Andy Moose Muse from an amazing southern rock band here in the UK, Sons of Liberty. They've chosen, again, this album, it's absolutely been on my hit list for quite some time. Lynyrd Skynyrd's, pronounced Lynyrd Skynyrd, the debut album, almost kind of ground zero for southern rock for me and for a lot of people, where it all began. So that conversation is coming up in just a couple of weeks' time. And it was great because until a couple of weeks ago, when we did the interview with Warning, I'd never done kind of an interview on My Classic Album with more than one member of a band. So I was always kind of curious as to how that would work. But obviously, thanks to the chat with the Warning, thanks to the one you'll hear in a couple of weeks with Fred and Moose, I'm quite confident that we'll probably do that more in the future as well. So, you know, it's cool to have different perspectives on the album. The conversation flows a bit differently. So that's coming up soon, and I hope you enjoy that. Yet another album that I've been anxious to do follows on the 1st of April. So again, anyone who knows me, just as they know I'm a huge Toto fan, they'll know I'm also a huge Ozzy Osbourne fan. So when Sammy Boller, fantastic guitarist, chose Ozzy's debut album, Blizzard of Oz, to talk about on the show, you know that I was excited and up for that. So that's coming up on the 1st of April. So we've just got some absolutely awesome chats coming. You know, it's a great time to be listening to My Classic Album. There's a few cool episodes coming up in the pipeline as well. Some albums you might not expect. There might be an anniversary special cooking. I don't want to say too much about that until I've got all the details. But absolutely, you know, if you're enjoying the podcast, keep it here. Great albums coming. MyClassicAlbum.co.uk is the place to be for all content around the podcast, and you can drop me a message. Make sure you hit subscribe so you never miss an episode of My Classic Album, so you don't miss the albums that you love being covered on the show. But there's not much else to say other than that today, really, which is good, because we've got some serious kind of total geeking out to do. My special guest from The Hot Damn is Lizzie Hayes. She has chosen, I always say fantastic, I'm going to use exquisite today, the exquisite Toto 4 as her classic album. But before we get to my chat with Lizzie, let's just have a look at the facts. Here's the beginning of what you need to know about Toto 4. Toto 4 is the fourth studio album by American rock band Toto. Released on the 8th of April, 1982, Toto 4 was released off the back of pressure from Columbia Records to match the success of the band's eponymous debut. Already a collection of the finest session musicians in the music industry, Toto came together to record an album that would exceed even their label's expectations. 5 of the 10 songs on Toto 4 were released as singles internationally, with first single Rosanna reaching number 2 on the US Billboard Hot 100 and number 8 on the UK Singles Chart. Album closer Africa exceeded Rosanna's commercial success, hitting the summit of the Hot 100 and reaching number 3 in the UK. While third single Make Believe made a minor splash in the US, I Won't Hold You Back and Waiting For Your Love continued Toto 4's momentum, with the former topping the Billboard Adult Contemporary chart in 1983. As if it was meant to be, Toto 4 peaked at, you guessed it, number 4 on both the US and UK album charts. The album did reach number 1 in Australia, Switzerland and the Netherlands. As sales increased and Toto 4 reached triple platinum status in America and gold in the UK, the album won 6 Grammys at the following year's Grammy Awards, with Rosanna itself winning 3 of those 6. Toto 4 stands as the band's most celebrated work, and its biggest hits remain pop culture milestones to this day. Guitarist magazine named Toto 4 the 50th most influential guitar album of all time in 1994, while CD Now in Japan placed the album 99th in their 100 Essential Albums in 2001. So that's just the beginning of everything we need to know about Toto 4, and I have here with me my very special guest who chose this album to talk about today on My Classic Album, from the Hot Damn. This is Lizzie Hayes. How are you doing?
Hi, I'm good. How are you, Mike?
I'm great. And as I was saying just before we hit record, I'm so excited that we're doing a Toto album, particularly this Toto album.
Yeah, it's a hard choice.
I mean, I guess that's a good question. That's a good place to start. So why have you chosen Toto 4 specifically as your classic album?
Well, it's a bit of a long-winded story, actually. So when I was a student about 450,000 years ago, I lived with a group of guys who were, like, you know, super into, you know, AOR and that kind of thing, which was, I guess, weird for the time, but I didn't really think of it then. But anyway, yeah, so we had NTL, right? Before it was Virgin Media, we had NTL, and it died one day. And we had only a GameCube with Mario Kart and one DVD, and it was Toto 25th anniversary. Live in Amsterdam. And this was before I even, like, played bass. I've always been musical, but I didn't really play at that point. And we watched this DVD probably about 400 times. Like, we just constantly had it on. And if we weren't watching that, we were playing Mario Kart. I mean, studying, sure. And I was just blown away by this band that I'd never heard of. And my housemate's dad was actually in a band called Toto Recall, which was like a Toto tribute band.
That's amazing.
Which I thought was possibly the best Toto tribute band name I've ever heard. Oh, yeah, I wonder why he's doing that. Anyway, so we were watching this DVD, and I watched the Africa live version, and I was just mesmerized by the bass player Mike Porcaro's bass solo in it. And those of you, I guess, who have seen this DVD, it's not the world's fanciest bass solo at all. It's not Billy Sheehan-esque. It is not like playing all the notes all the time. It is just so solid. It's just all of the right notes at all of the right times, you know? And I was just like, I was blown away by it. I was like, I have to learn this. You know, I have to. So my housemate had a bass, and so I learned this bass line and stuff, which was weird because obviously Mike Porcaro plays a 5-string PV Cirrus, and I only had a absolute piece of, you know what, can I swear on this one?
Absolutely.
Or not? Okay, great. absolute piece of shit Squire P bass thing. And I, you know, I was just like, oh, I can't get it to sound right. And I spent so much time on this that my housemate came in and was just like, have you heard that these guys, like, recorded? Have you heard any of this? And I was like, well, no, I've just literally heard this DVD and I love it. But I guess, yeah, of course, I should probably check out the recorded stuff. And he gave me Toto 4. And that was the gateway drug for Toto for me, really, I guess. Like, I heard that album and I was like, oh, they've probably got, like, a couple or whatever, you know. Didn't realise quite the extensive back catalogue that they had. And I certainly didn't appreciate how proficient and how prolific, they were in the session scene at the time either. So I kind of like had this album on repeat, and it's kind of basically been like not only, I guess, the accompaniment to my, you could call it, musical career as a bass player, but it's also kind of introduced me to many different guys that I've ended up playing with in bands and different bands as well, and some like really, really close friends. So that album's kind of been quite pivotal to my, well, not just my musical career, but my life in general, really, I guess. I've met a lot of people through it, and I've played in a lot of bands through it. So.
Yeah. And I guess that's it. I guess that's the definition of a true classic album, isn't it? It's, you know, there's one thing having an album, one album that you enjoy and that you like listening to, but it's when it has an impact on your life, which it really has in this instance.
Yeah, it really did, actually. Yeah, it really did. I absolutely blame. I blame Toto for the reason that I picked up the bass in the first place, which is not, I mean, at the time it wasn't particularly cool, and I don't think it's particularly cool now, but I don't give a shit. Like, those guys are awesome, and I don't give a fuck.
I think it's kind of the charm. I mean, obviously, I'm sure we'll get into, like, the critics, like, savage Toto constantly, but...
Yeah.
I mean, it's like you say, these guys, you know, a band full of extremely talented, accomplished musicians.
Yeah.
As you'd said, you know, they played as session musicians, you know, before this album, you know, Sonny and Cher through Steely Dan.
Yeah.
You know, the word...
Paul Skaggs, like, even the Grease soundtrack, you know?
Exactly. Like, these, you know, just everywhere, they pop up all over the place. And
they do, yeah.
The word Toto, I read, actually, it comes from the Latin term for, like, all over. Or all-encompassing, so it's kind of the perfect name for them.
It is, isn't it?
Do you hear that kind of depth and scope on Toto 4? All kind of all the Toto albums, is there that same kind of depth in?
I think so, yeah. Definitely. I think, you know, they've... So you've got like Fahrenheit, for example, right? And you can hear the Michael Jackson influences on that album. And then you've got like the more like balls out rock stuff of like, you know... like Girl Goodbye and you know, you've got the more funky stuff, like, I mean, Rosanna, to be fair, and you know, you can hear where they've got everything from, and they've taken all of those influences and repackaged it and sold it to whatever guys kind of want them to play. And I just think that's insanely talented, you know.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And I think, I know you were saying, like, it's a hard choice to pick a total album to talk about. Obviously, this is the most successful, and we'll dive into all that. I think another one that could have been potentially a front runner would have been the debut from 1978.
Yeah. It could have been. Controversially, perhaps the debut isn't. I mean, it's not. Well, it's probably not my top three. Only, I think, maybe because I think I've heard it too much. Firstly, I used to play in a prog band that we did a cover of one of the tracks on it, which I actually forget now, which is kind of bad of me because we played it quite a lot. But Kingdom of Desire, I would say, is up there as well, because I really like the stripped back four piece approach to it, where, you know, Joseph Williams, they'd fired at that point, and they were getting like Jean-Michel Byron in, and obviously Luther hated Jean-Michel Byron, and he ended up singing on the album. And you know what, I'm gonna go out and say that I think Luther is probably the best singer Toto's had. That guy, he's such a bastard. Why is he so good at everything? That's not fair. Like, I wish I could play, like, well, I mean, bass, obviously, as well, and sing as well, and write amazing songs like that. You know, like, what a dick.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, we're talking about all of these albums. I think it kind of the front end of their career, they experienced, surprisingly, a bit of that kind of dreaded second album slump, commercially at least, if not creatively. You know, Hydra, its follow-up Turn Back, they failed to match that high expectation that the debut had set. What are your thoughts on those albums? Why do you think they're maybe not as highly regarded as some of the others that we're talking about?
I can't really put my finger on quite why. I think for me, I mean, they're not personal favourites of mine either. I think for me, the songwriting is a little... I think it gets a little bit too, for want of a better phrase, up its own arse.
Okay.
I think it kind of gets a little bit convoluted. It gets a little bit too clever for clever's sake in some instances. And I think it's a thing I have with prog anyway quite a lot, is a lot of the time they forget that it does have to be a song. People will want to have to listen to it, right? Otherwise, it can't just be something that no one can listen to. Not saying that it goes that far, but... I think for me, I mean, maybe they just wanted to write it for themselves and it just, you know, and it pleased them, but it wasn't necessarily what the general market wanted. I think also they had a lot of backlash at the time as well, didn't they?
Yeah.
So I guess maybe that sort of happened too. I'm not so sure. I mean, I probably would, if I was around at the time, I probably would have bought the albums anyway, just because. But yeah, I can't say I'm massive fans of either of them, really. I mean, the title tracks are probably about as far as I'll get with it. And I don't know, it just seemed like a lot of filler and not a lot of hit after hit, like, you know, like Toto 4 and the self-titled first album. They've struggled with that throughout their career, I think, though. They've kind of like released like a handful of great albums, like Isolation as well. Like Fergie Frederiksen is one of my favorite, you know, RIP obviously, but he was one of my favorite singers in Toto. It's Lukather, Fergie Frederiksen, Joe Williams for me, I think. But I think even I forget where I was going with that because I got sidetracked. They released a couple of albums, then it kind of dips again, and then they released some other crackers with some brilliant songs on, and then it sort of dips out again. It's just natural, I guess. You can't constantly have hit album after hit album after hit album, can you really? I mean, how many songs must those guys have written between them? Not, you know, just for Toto, but because obviously Human Nature was written by Steve Porcaro, wasn't it? Michael Jackson's Human Nature was written by Steve Porcaro. And how much money do you reckon he made from that? Oh my God. That's insane, isn't it?
It's crazy.
And it wasn't even pitched for Michael Jackson. It was just a B-side or something, wasn't it? It was just something else on the cassette tape that was handed in. Oh, I hate those guys. They're so talented.
I mean, we've talked a bit about Steve Lukather already, and I've got a few quotes from him. He's a really funny guy. I think he's so self-deprecating. Yeah. And I mean, that relative lack of success from those albums actually meant the Toto, they were teetering towards being dropped by their label, Columbia.
That's right, they were, weren't they?
Yeah. And I mean, Steve talked about that with Ultimate Classic Rock. So he said the record company was like, okay, guys, we let you do what you want to do. Are you going to give us a hit record? Because if you don't, we're going to drop you. We just said, you know what? We're going to do what we do well. And I think that must be such a scary time. I think obviously we hear this with other bands as well, that, you know, they have this huge barnstorming first success. They struggle to match it. And then all of a sudden, this might be the end of the road.
Yeah. It must have been quite scary for them, really. But then I wonder if it would have been, because they'd obviously been propelled quite considerably by their successful first couple of albums and whatnot. Mm. I wonder if actually they did go, well, I mean, if we do, we probably retain considerably more songwriting and publishing rights and probably be able to work at our own schedule. And we're making a mint from playing on other people's records. So I wonder if that actually was a thing for them or whether they just thought, well, we've had a fair amount of success. We are already a, for want of a better phrase, a household name. Would this really have affected them? I wonder if it would have. I mean, if things had been different, I wonder what would have happened then.
No. And I think what's more crazy about this situation, obviously we've talked a little bit about Michael Jackson already. We're like early 80s, 1982. Toto was still session musicians lending their services elsewhere, as we're saying. Many of the band, you know, while they're recording Toto 4, when the same year it was released, they were playing on Michael Jackson's Thriller. So the best-selling album of all time, we're saying, you know, Human Nature, you know, all of this kind of stuff. So here we are, this unthinkable situation that potentially they could be dropped from their label, but they're also playing on arguably the biggest album of all time, which is just a crazy thought.
Yeah, it's mad, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's absolutely crazy. I think Steve touches upon that in his book as well, doesn't he? He sort of says, like, it was a bit of a fuck you, because it's like, well, I mean, everyone hates us, but we're literally on every album everybody loves. So go fuck yourselves, kind of thing. You know, he's quite like that in his book, isn't he? Which I enjoyed.
Yeah. There was definitely an element of that kind of, that fuck you kind of feeling. I mean, I've got another quote from him here from that interview with Ultimate Classic Rock. He said, we were pissed off that we'd been slagged, that we hadn't been as successful as we had been with the debut. Everyone had grown as writers and performers. We were all writing more. I certainly was. We just decided to kill that one, and we did. We're really proud of it. I remember listening back to it and thinking, I think we have something here, guys. I mean, do you think that there's a sense, with everything we're talking about, there's this kind of that fuck you attitude, kind of what the critics are saying, the fact that, as you say, they're a huge part of the music scene in general. Do you think that this album is, do you think it is a bit of a fuck you, a bit of a, we've got something to prove here and here we are?
I mean, I think so. Yeah, I think so. I mean, Toto 4, like the arrangements on it are insane. They're mind blowing arrangements. You know, I think David Paich did a lot of that, didn't he? His dad not a really famous composer? Well, not famous, but very prolific composer, songwriter, arranger. Like I think he did a lot of the Michael Jackson stuff too, memory serves. So his arrangements and vocal arrangements and stuff are absolutely insane. And then we've got the part writing that you know, the guitar work and stuff like that, which, I mean, Luke's just like the greatest guitar player ever, isn't he? So like he's got that down in solos, the way that things build, you know, through the solo. He's the master of going into a solo. Like he's the absolute boss of going, okay, well, the solo's starting on bar one, so the fourth bar before that or whatever, I'm going to absolutely smash you a new one when I go into that solo, and you're going to know it's there. Yeah. Like he's such a boss with that kind of thing. And, you know, I'm no guitar player, but you know, I've dated a fair few of my time. Just the way that he does that is, you know, nobody does it like Luke, does he? You
know? I mean, obviously we're talking about that debut album as well. I think that's such you've said it's maybe not in your top three, but it's certainly, you know, a record that people really hold in high esteem. Yep. We've got tracks like Hold the Line, Georgie Porgy, all of that kind of stuff.
It's... Georgie Porgy, that was the one that I did.
Ah, was it?
No. Oh, wait, no, it wasn't. I'll get, it's on the tip of my tongue. I'll get there eventually.
But I mean, the shadow of this album's looming a bit large through that part of Toto's career that I think with those other two, people are being like, oh, well, it's not the debut, is it? It's not the same. We've talked about those albums in between. Do you think
it's a lot poppier, I think.
Than the other two?
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think that Toto 4 harkens back to that, or do you think it's trying something completely different?
No, I think it's trying something completely different, actually. I think you've got like a couple of sort of bridge songs, I suppose, you know, like you've got, you know, Rosanna in there that sort of, I think sort of links it quite nicely into the new album, or newer album, I suppose, you know, but the songs are way poppier, you know, like Make Believe, Good For You, even I Won't Hold You Back, a ballad. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a pop rock album, I think. It's definitely not the heavy rock stuff that they were doing before, or heavy for the time that, you know, that they were doing before. Absolutely not.
So to talk a little bit about the album's production, Rockpastor say it's at this moment that the two heavyweights, David Paich and Bobby Kimball, take the reins of the band to recompose the songs on the album and mix the voices during the songs. They went from doing a boogie style to taking hold, as you've just said, in this soft rock with very West Coast overtones, which is where the band has moved best, with a more significant Luther on guitar. And we obviously, you know, you've made it very clear kind of how much you love Luke on guitar and stuff. Do you think this album, do you think he plays a more prominent role on Toto 4 than he has before?
I would still say, like, his rhythm playing is very much pop rock, I think. Absolutely. Or what do we call it now? Yacht rock, isn't it? That's the term, I think, yacht rock. But I think those solos and stuff are still like really sort of driven, really sort of rocky. I think that sort of takes the rock element in and kind of adds that flavor to an otherwise kind of quite poppy, songwriting wise anyway, quite poppy album. Yeah.
I mean, Steve has said that with Toto 4, that they aimed for excess. I've read the start of this quote earlier there about just deciding to kill that one. We're really proud of it. We had the full London strings. We just went, fuck this. We're going to go for the biggest, most obnoxiously overproduced record of all time. And it turns out that's what we do best. Now, I think usually when we use the term overproduced, we're saying that in a negative way. I don't necessarily feel like, isn't it, since like, would you say this is an overproduced album? But when we're saying that, I don't think we're knocking it, if that makes sense.
I mean, I clearly missed the memo when overproduced was a negative term. I think I missed that memo because, like, is it not just relevant to the style that you're doing? So, for example, if they'd applied the same kind of production to, I don't know, the White Stripes or something, that would have been too much. But if you're applying the same thing to like the 1975, that's absolutely perfect. You know, that works very well with that kind of thing. So I think I don't like the term overproduced because what is overproduction? Like the term itself doesn't really make much sense. I think production is relevant, is relative to the style of music that you're doing. Like, if you want to go and just go all out and apply everything you can because it's for the good of the album and the good of the song, I don't think that's overproduced. I think that's just relative, isn't it? Whereas overproduced could be interpreted in many different ways, just, you know, depending on what style I think that you're going for.
I think it goes back to that kind of critical, that harsh critique that the critics gave them. You know, again, thinking of other bands that might have been given this overproduced tag, so like Queen, Def Leppard, who would get this kind of mauling from the critics, but the music's amazing.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it just sounds to me like critics are trying to turn something into a negative when they just need something to slag off about a band. Like, you know, nowadays we regard, you know, Queen as one of the greatest rock bands of all time, Toto as well. And, you know, I wonder if in, like, I don't know, 40 years time, we'll be looking back on, I don't know, like Foo Fighters albums and going, that was so overproduced. Or no, of course we won't be. We'll be going, you know, that was relative to the time an excellent rock album that you know, was in keeping with what you're expecting for the period. And just critics and stupid terminologies, man. Like, it just doesn't, I don't know, that overproduction, overproduced, doesn't make any sense to me. Yeah. Just sounds a bit like you're trying to make a positive into a negative because you can't find anything else to write about.
Yeah. And I think for me, obviously, when I think about the production on this album, and the word I've written down here is that it's like ambitious. I thought it's overproduced. Mm. It's ambitious.
It's ambitious. Yeah. It's groundbreaking for the time. I mean, we look back on albums like that with all the knowledge that we have in 2022. You know, and it wasn't 2022, it was 1982.
Yeah.
Like, that stuff wasn't, you know, as rife as it is now. You know, you couldn't get a little interface and all of a sudden have a number one record just because you produced something in your bedroom on a Mac and a keyboard. Like, you paid tens of thousands of pounds, dollars, whatever, to go into a studio, and it was just unobtainable for so many people. You know, nowadays anyone can do it, which, you know, that's probably another conversation for another day as to whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. But, you know, regardless, there aren't many albums that are pushing boundaries like Toto 4 did, or like Queen did, or whatever, coming through these days. So I don't know. But then that's rock, isn't it? And, you know, maybe there are in other areas, you know, like your grime, your trap. I mean, I'm sorry, I probably sound like a grandma because I don't really know much about that kind of music. But, you know, I had a conversation with someone the other day that was saying that grime and trap is the punk rock of the modern era. And I'm like, I can totally see that. I can totally see that. So basically, on a meandering tangent, everything is relative. And we are looking at these things with all the knowledge that we have in 2022.
Exactly. I mean, there's some huge songs on this album, and we're going to go track by track shortly. I mean, the album bookended by two monster hits.
Oh, I know.
Rosanna and Africa. So obviously we're going to talk about them both plenty when we dive in track by track. Across the 10 tracks, Sputnik Music praised the musical range of the album. So they say, what's surprising is how much personality Toto show here. They change styles almost every song, but there's an underlying personality that just wasn't shown on their other albums. It's very, very hard to describe, but overall, I think they just sound more invested. So, I mean, would you agree with that? I think it's weird, but true. Like, they jump between styles, but it's still unmistakably Toto.
Yeah, and isn't that a talent?
Absolutely.
Like, you can go from a rock track to a sort of funk track to a ballad to to everything, literally, on this track, on this album, you know. And it's always got that underlying playful tone to it. It doesn't seem to matter what style they write in. It's unmistakably and undeniably Toto.
And I mean, upon its release, obviously, as we've said, it was their most successful album of their career. That huge hit that both the band and the label were hoping for. Selling over 3 million copies in the US alone. These huge hit singles we're talking about ultimately won 6 Grammy Awards, including Album of the Year, Producer of the Year, the band self-produced it, and Rosanna. I mean, I think Rosanna had 3 Grammys of its own, but one of those was Record of the Year. So we're about to head track by track and talk about Rosanna and those other great songs. But why do you think the album achieved that huge initial success that it did? Obviously, we'll talk about its kind of lasting impact towards the end. But why do you think it achieved that huge initial success upon its release?
I think there's something for everyone on it, though, isn't there? There's, you know, you might not like the rock stuff, so you've got the more chilled out stuff, and you've got that on there as well. And you've got like the heartfelt I Won't Hold You Back, which, you know, that's something that's a bit more kind of like, you know, low key. Well, I mean, it's not low key. It's still like produced to the nines, you know, but you've got something a bit more laid back, I suppose, and more heartfelt. You've got like the Rosanna, you've got Lovers in the Night, that driving sort of that very sort of AOR driving track. I mean, driving as in you're in a car and, you know, it's like a good sort of like road trip song. You know, I think there's just something for everyone, and that's why it was as successful as it was, you know.
Yeah. So let's dive in track by track. And we'll start, of course, with Rosanna, one of their most iconic songs. Both Steve Lukather and Steve Vaccaro have described Rosanna as the ultimate Toto track. Why is it held in such a high regard, and how does it kick off the album for you?
Well, it's got that halftime shuffle groove, hasn't it, that kicks it off before anything else starts. It's got that undeniably Jeff Vaccaro halftime shuffle that starts it off, which I think, because I'm a bit of a loser, and I've watched Jeff Vaccaro's drumming, not DVD, but VHS. And he said that he got that from Zeppelin's Fool in the Rain.
Yeah.
It just kind of starts off that kind of like bounce, you know, and then you've got the keys come in, and it builds, the track builds. So it starts off like this, and then it just escalates up through to, like, you know, the solos. Oh, it's an excellent song. It's excellently well written. The structure's perfect. The arrangement's perfect. It's one of those songs lyrically that I don't think really means anything. It's just about a girl. And it can be applied to everyone. Like, anyone can kind of take that. Whether it's, you know, it doesn't have to be about a girl. It's about a partner. It's about someone you fancy, you know. And it's, I think everyone can relate to that. So I think that's why that track is as popular as it is. And it still is. It's got like, what, like nearly a billion plays on Spotify or something ridiculous?
Yeah, something crazy.
It's nuts,
something
isn't it?
Crazy.
It's, yeah. It's nuts. I mean, I don't think it did that well over here, though, did it? I mean, I don't think it even got into the top 10 over here, but it was obviously monstrous in America.
Yeah. And I think it's funny, I know when we were discussing what album you were going to pick, I think one of the things we talked about was potentially Nevermind by Nirvana, but it had already been covered. And I think during the conversation we had on that episode, we were saying that sometimes, you know, Kurt Cobain's lyrics were just like nonsense,
yeah,
you know, but it served the song. And
yeah,
I'm by no means suggesting that the lyrics of Rosanna are nonsense, but again, they don't need to be anything particularly deep and meaningful as long as they serve the song. And it's a really good example of that, I think, on this one.
Yeah, definitely. And one of the things I really like about it is the way that it starts off with Steve Lukather, and then as it builds, it kind of like changes register, and then Bobby takes over and he's like doing the high bits, you know, like kicking some ass, singing the high notes. And I really like that switch between the two that they have on there, which is really cool.
And quite unique, I think, for rock, certainly. I think that's quite a unique thing.
I think so too. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Like, cause you know, Luke's obviously got that sort of, you know, smoked 40 fags a day, kind of like rock kind of vocal, but Bobby was more like that country Nashville guy, wasn't he? He was more that sort of soul kind of vibes, which I think really sort of, they complement each other really well on that track.
Yeah, absolutely. I know you talked a bit about that kind of that halftime shuffle, or I've actually heard it called the Rosanna shuffle.
I think John Bonham might turn in his grave about that one. But yeah.
Well, exactly. Yeah, I know. But I guess, you know, as you were saying there, you know, it was heavily influenced by his performance on Fool in the Rain. You know, it sounds like you agree there's definitely a parallel between those two drum tracks.
Oh yeah, definitely. Definitely. I mean, I love Fool in the Rain as well. That's an amazing track. I mean, controversially, I'm probably more of a fan of Zeppelin's later stuff than the early stuff. But I do obviously love Zeppelin's early stuff too, just, you know, before the haters get in. But obviously I do. But I think, you know, because everyone knows Zeppelin and all the, you know, the famous tracks and the early stuff or whatever, I don't think the later stuff gets the attention that it might, you know, necessarily deserve. So I also do appreciate that stuff, which is, I think, why I like what Jeff's interpretation of that is on this track. It's a bit like the Purdy shuffle as well. It's kind of like a bit of a bastard love child of the two, isn't it? You know, and it just shows his talent, you know, which is just really, really great on this track. I absolutely love playing along to this, you know, and it's David Hungate on this album, actually. It's not my hero, Mr. Picaro. But interestingly, have you ever heard this track separated?
I haven't, actually.
You can get various different bits and pieces on YouTube, like separate sort of, you know, like the stems they would have had in the studio or whatever.
Yeah.
And the separated bass line sounds awful. Like, I'm just like, what? How does it sound like that? Like separate? It just sounds like this old piece of shit P bass that, you know, David Hungate's playing, you know, obviously one of the top session guys of the day. But it's just, I think, one of those producer moments where they've just gone like, that on its own, don't like it. But that within everything is adding something. You know, it's like, it's not in the way of anything else. It's sitting quite nicely in the mix. You know, it's audible, which I have a real problem with producers and engineers at the minute when they mix tracks. And it's just like, oh, okay, so why did I even bother showing up to the studio? You haven't put that in the mix at all. Thankfully, the guys that we work with in the Hot Damn are, they know the love of the bass, you know.
Mm-hmm. So it's here. Classic And Justice for All, isn't it?
Yeah. Fortunately, there's not And Justice for Lizzie, so I'm very pleased about that.
Yeah.
So it sits so wonderfully in the mix, and obviously, you know, David Hungate's an amazing player as well. He rejoined them, didn't he, for a few shows, maybe not so long ago.
Oh right, no, I wasn't sure.
Yeah, that's cool. I think around the time maybe Keith Carlock was playing drums. Okay. Them, I think. I mean, awesome. Someone in the comments or whatever, correct me on that one. But yeah, I think that's what happened. I think it was maybe only a couple of shows, because he, shortly after this album, actually, I think shortly after Toto 4, did he not just get a little bit shirty with the band?
Yeah, it's definitely around this time, shortly after the album, that he left the band.
I think he was struggling with like family commitments and touring extensively with the band and that, wasn't he? And I think he just sort of had enough after a while, which, you know, I can understand that, but especially a band touring as much as they were,
and again, all the session work they were doing, and you know, it seems like they never stopped.
I know.
I mean, talking to international musician Steve Lukather also revealed that his solo at the end of Rosanna, and indeed the final moments of Rosanna in general, were all improvised on the spot, which, I mean, how crazy is that? He said, that was straight off. I just went for it. Everyone said, but the thing at the end is just blowing. That's not doubled. It was a one-off, which luckily you happen to get once in a while. As a matter of fact, the song was supposed to end, but Jeff carried on. Dave started playing the honky-tonk piano, and we all just followed on. And that's one of my favourite parts of the song,
like
that cool little bit at the end, to think that was improvised, because you say that the song, it builds and builds and builds, and then at the end, it's almost like that intensity just sort of carries on.
It's
with
so
that
playful, you know. Mm. It's so playful. I think it shows a real sort of relaxed attitude in the studio too, because, you know, they were all so familiar in that environment and so comfortable that, you know, just to sort of carry on and go, fuck it, let's just jam out the end of this song. And also I will refer you to my previous comment of what a bastard, just like, oh, you know, just played that off the cuff. Yeah, brilliant, thanks Steve.
Like, cheers, mate.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I wish my just carrying on at the end of the song sounded as good as that, you know. But usually people are shouting at me to stop.
I mean, obviously, we've talked about it being a huge hit, particularly in America. As we've said, 6 Grammys that they won in 1983, 3 of them were for Rosanna. So just for clarity, it was Record of the Year, Best Instrumental Arrangement Accompanying Vocals, and Best Vocal Arrangement for 2 or More Voices.
Yep.
So they were the Grammys that it won. You know, obviously, everything we're talking about, the critical acclaim, kind of commercial success, is that enough to agree with the two Steves at the top there that Rosanna is the ultimate Toto track?
Yes, I would tentatively say so, but I am also thinking, you know, maybe selfishly, I do have other like favorite tracks, and I would also maybe say that it might be what Steve or Steve's squared think that the audience think is the ultimate Toto track, but I would arguably say that maybe tracks like Jake to the Bone, Dave's Gone Skiing, maybe they're the real ultimate Toto tracks, because they're the ones that perhaps they've just gone, we want to do like a rock fusion track, fuck it, let's go. You know, like, but yes, I would say that it is a solid favorite. It is a classic, and it's got everything in there that Toto are known for.
Yeah.
So it's a firm contender. It's a firm contender. Absolutely.
Cool. So let's move on to Make Believe.
Yes.
So our second track of the album, also released as the second single in the US. I think it was the third over here in Europe. What are your thoughts on Make Believe? Do you think it was a good choice? Bearing in mind, we've got two massive three massive singles on this album. Do you think this was a good choice to accompany those?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's one of my favorites from the album. You know, it's starting off with that nice little sort of like right hand piano bit. You know, that it builds to the crescendo of the da 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 da. You know, it's got everything to follow on from Rosanna. As not only as track two, but also as the second single, I think it does lead in quite nicely, because you've got that that marriage of the sort of honky tonk piano at the end of Rosanna into the piano intro of Make Believe. So it's, I think it does feed in quite nicely. Hat tips.
The website Album of the Year, they say that Make Believe has a really sweet vocal delivery and is an underrated classic from the band. So again, we consider the two elephants in the room bookending this album. Do you think maybe it is an underrated track?
I think it is an underrated track. And I also think, I know, you know, Bobby's a controversial character of late, but I also think it showcases his vocal prowess quite well as well. He's got like a load of really lovely ad-libs, you know, towards the end of that track. And I read that David Paich really had to ride him really, really hard to get that performance out of him on this album. And, you know, I think maybe he was struggling or had struggled with substance abuse in the past. And to sort of, for David to push him as hard as he did and for him to deliver with that performance, I think, you know, this is one of Bobby's standout tracks, actually, to be honest.
Yeah. And it's interesting you should say that. I've got a quote from a site called Something Else Reviews, and they essentially agree, saying of all the Kimball Sung songs, Make Believe is probably a favorite, second only to You Are the Flower from their first album. I mean, does that sound about right in terms of, if you know, to be fair, sometimes a bit of a pointless exercise kind of ranking and all this kind of stuff, but you know, would you say that maybe they're two standout moments for Bobby?
Absolutely. I mean, I prefer Make Believe over You Are the Flower, but again, I think both showcases his abilities amazingly. Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I would say this one more so, just personally out of preference, but I think maybe on You Are the Flower, he's kind of, you know, struggling to find his position within the band, but this is just absolutely solid on Make Believe. But that's just personal opinion. I mean, you know, don't hate me for that. I don't think Toto fans would hate me, though. I just, you know, I think they'd be like, oh yeah, she knows about Toto.
Yeah, exactly. Like, to be fair, like my best friend, who's the best man at my wedding and everything, obviously I haven't told him yet because I never announced these episodes until we've recorded them, but when I message him and tell him that we've done Toto 4, he will lose his mind. like and that's one of the things that bonds us together, is our love of Toto.
It's funny you say that. I've got a very, very dear friend of mine who I used to play in the prog band with, actually, the drummer, guy called Jimmy Palagrossi. He's a absolutely amazing drummer. We bonded over Toto. That's how we sort of ended up really kind of solidifying our friendship and our rhythm section as well. We were in a rehearsal room one time, and well, actually it wasn't one time, it was the day that Mike Beccaro died. I remember he was charging his phone, he went over to it and he looked at it, he was like, oh no. And I was like, oh, what's up, you're right? And he was like, oh, just, you know, just the bass player in my favorite band, he's just died. And I was like, oh, who's your favorite band? He's like, oh, you probably don't know them. Like, it's a guy called Mike Beccaro, and you know, it's a band called Toto. And I was like, are you fucking serious? I was like, Toto, like, my favorite band ever, and Mike Beccaro is the reason I play bass. So you just told me he's died. I was like, for fuck's sake. But I was like, you know, if I was going to find out anywhere, I would have preferred it to have been in a rehearsal room with a dude that absolutely idolizes Jeff Beccaro. So.
Yeah,
sad. Absolutely. Times.
Aye. So we'll move on to I Won't Hold You Back. So things slow down a little bit for our next track. Steve Lukather handles lead vocals and brings in Eagles bass player Timothy E. Schmidt to support backing vocals.
Yes, that's right.
So the youngfolks.com say, "I Won't Hold You Back" encompasses a melancholy guitar solo resembling that of a Queen hit and creates that empathy feel of pain. So I'm an absolute sucker for a good harmony, which I think for you, obviously, when you're talking about your deep love of Toto, obviously, you know, I've said how much I love Toto, but Queen are my number one. Yeah. Absolutely. I think that's where my love of harmony comes from.
Yes.
Do you feel a Queen vibe with the harmonies on this track?
Yeah. Now, I mean, I haven't thought of it until you've said that, but thinking about it now, yeah, absolutely. There's absolutely a queen hat tip to this, isn't there? And I know exactly what you mean. I'm a massive sucker for a harmony. In fact, you know, when I'm with the guys in the Hot Damn, like when we're, you know, at the pub or whatever after the gig and, you know, just having a few and singing along to all the songs on the radio, they always wind me up because I always sing the harmony. They're like, "Why don't you sing the main line?" And I'm like, "I don't know. My ear doesn't go there, you know." And I swear it's because of Toto. Like, there's so many to choose from. I just like picking and choosing, you know, the ones to sing. And I think it, you know, this track especially for me, I practiced a lot of like ear training with singing to a lot of Toto tracks, but this one in particular as well, because that chorus harmony is just magnificent, and picking out each one and learning it and stuff like that was a real good bit of practice for me. You know, you're driving somewhere and you got it on, you're like, yeah, just gonna sing along really loudly because no one can hear. I couldn't sing and play for a long time, and I got a gig in a band and they were like, can you sing BVs? And I was like, yeah, you know, as you do, when really what I meant was absolutely not. I've never done this before. But yeah, I just thought, fuck it, how difficult could it be? Turns out quite hard. But yeah, and just practicing along to this track really kind of helped me to be able to progress. So thanks, Toto, again.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, Steve said of the song, Steve Lukather said he wrote it during the Turn Back sessions in 81, but he didn't feel like it fit on that album. Do you get where he's coming from there? Does it feel more at home here on Total 4 than it would have on Turn Back?
Yeah, totally. The track listing for this album feels a lot like maybe like a set list, a gig set list. So it's kind of like two powerful openers and then we bring it down, you know. And I think that's kind of where this fits in this album. There's two really high powered openers. And then it's like, okay, now we're going to kind of bring you back a little bit. We're going to kind of, we're going to bring the emotions out, you know? And I think it wouldn't have fitted on Turn Back. I wouldn't have thought, I don't know, but somehow, but then I don't know how it manages to fit on this either. I mean, it's, but I think it does because as we said earlier, each song is so different and it's such an eclectic album. That's a perfect word. But it all has that sort of reoccurring theme of being Toto as fuck the entire way through, you know, like those crazy solos. I think it's the solos that marry it all together, you know, because there's a decent solo on pretty much every track and it kind of follows a relatively similar sound and feel, doesn't it? So I would say that, I mean, probably amongst other things, I'm sure. But for me, I think those solos are what kind of marries the whole album together. God, guitarists are going to love me, aren't they?
The opening lines were famously sampled for the song Another Chance. So the 2001 single by house DJ Roger Sanchez. So we're dipping into territory that I'm very unfamiliar with.
I remember this. Yeah.
I actually do. Yeah, I'm the same. So I'm not a fan of house music by any stretch, but I definitely remember the song.
It was all over the radio, wasn't it? It was massive.
Didn't
Lukather famously joke it bought him a new house or something like that?
I think so.
A new house in the Beverly Hills or something like that.
Yeah, and I think what's crazy about it is that for me, so thinking, so in 2001, I'll have been about 15 years old. So I don't think I'd discovered Toto yet at that point. So those lines that are in, that are sampled on Another Chance, that was my first exposure to those lines, even though I didn't like the song. So the first time I heard this song many years later, and just that clicking moment of, I've heard these lyrics before. Kind of, where are they from? And of course, it's from Another Chance.
Yes.
For you, was that the same story for you? Like, or had you heard
this song before? I don't know how old you think before? I am, Mike. How old do you think I am?
Oh, that's a dangerous question.
It's a dangerous question. I guarantee you'll go in under, so I feel safe with it. I'm 35, so I do actually remember it as well.
Ah, so am I.
Ah, there we go. So we were the same age when this came out.
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember it being all over the radio. It was a massive, mm-hmm. massive hit in this country, certainly. I'm not so sure abroad, but it was certainly a massive hit in this country. And I remember the exact same thing. Again, it was when I was back watching that 25th anniversary. And I was just like, I know this song. And then I was like, where do I know this from? Was it that terrible dance hit? Yes, it was. It was the terrible dance hit. Because obviously in 2001, I was like, you know, I was like goth as fuck. Mm. But really bad at being a goth because I was reasonably cheerful. And I ran out of like corpse paint. So I was a terrible goth, really, truth be told. But I was a passable emo at that stage. I absolute, or grunges, as we used to call them, definitely would have scoffed at that song when it came out. But then little did I know, a matter of years later, like, I don't know, I was a student, 2007. Yeah, 2007. So literally 6 years later, I'd have been like, oh, I love this song.
And we've not even got to Africa yet. So Africa in my house is like music royalty. My daughter loves Africa. It's a ringtone on my phone. It's just an amazing song. Obviously, we will talk about that once we get to the end of Track by Track. My conversation with Lizzie Hayes will continue in just a little bit. I'd love to know your thoughts on Toto 4, on any of the albums that we've talked about, just in general. You know, if you just fancy a chat, make sure that you get to myclassicalbum.co.uk and send me a message, or make sure you're following us on the social media channels. My Classic Album with Mike Norris on Facebook, My Classic Album Podcast on Instagram, at @MCA_podcast on Twitter. So plenty of places you can get in touch with the show. However, let's get to some important stuff now. Let's play the latest single from The Hot Damn. They are absolutely a band to watch. You know, they're touring all over this year, hopefully going to be getting in the studio. Obviously, Lizzie will fill you in all of that at the end of our interview. But for now, here is the latest single from the girls. This is The Hot Damn with I Didn't Like You Anyway.
I'll
So we'll move on to Good For You. The Young Folks single out Good For You, calling it an extremely drum-filled track. The best example to showcase the talent of Toto with the included combination of so many well-liked styles. It presents Kimball in his reckless and edgy brilliance, as well as coalescing the seemingly effortless musicians behind him. So we've talked already, obviously, any Toto album or any album they played on, quite frankly, is a showcase for their talent. But do you think this is a moment for Jeff Beccaro to shine on drums?
Yes, it is very, very drum orientated. Like, Good For You is a great track. And yes, it absolutely does showcase Bobby again. But that Good For You is like a nice kind of lead into It's a Feeling, which is the bookend of side A.
I think in terms of Good For You, something else reviews have a slight criticism of this one, saying my only real complaint with Good For You is Roger Lynn's fanfare embellishments.
Yes, no, like the, no, I don't like the fanfare. Like it strikes me almost that they had a brass section and they were just like, well, we've got a couple of hours left of the day rate. So let's add a few fanfares in, you know. It kind of sounds like a bit like that to me, but you know.
Yeah, I mean, obviously in terms of It's a Feeling, Steve Beccaro takes lead vocals. I know you'd said it's typically Steve Beccaro. Do you think it's the right move to have his vocals on this track ahead of, say, Bobby's more powerful voice? So I know, and obviously you love Luke's voice. Like, do you think it was the right move to have Steve's vocals on this one as we kind of end side one?
You know what? I actually didn't realize it was Steve Beccaro singing on this for a long time. I thought it was just a more mellow Lukather for a long time. I really did think that. And it was only quite recently that I discovered that it was actually Steve Beccaro singing. And I think fair fucking play. You know, he's not known as the singer. He's known as an incredible synth and keys player, but he and sound designer as well, you know, because he's credited as that on this album, I think, isn't he? He's credited as sound design or something like that. I think it's a bold move. But I think you're not in Toto if you shit in any way at all. So why not? You know,
yeah.
Why not? If he wanted to sing it and it's his song, there's nothing wrong with his vocal. I don't think it's necessarily the strongest, but I've got no problem with it. I really don't. I think he did a really, really strong effort, considering he's not, or at least not as far as I know, known as being a singer.
Yeah, I was watching an interview of Steve's with a guy called John Bowden, and John asked him about this song, and he'd said something along the lines of, "Oh, I'm sure you've been asked this a million times." And Steve was like, "No, no one ever asks me about that song." You could see his eyes kind of light up when he was talking about it. And one of the things that he'd said was, "What's really important to me is atmosphere. I love songs that start and I feel like I'm in a place." Do you think that's something he succeeded with on here? Do you think it creates an atmosphere?
I think absolutely. It's that atmospheric kind of design that he does that is also reminiscent of human nature. He does the same sort of thing in that track, I think. Although, you know, I'm not saying they sound similar. It's just the same sort of theme, I think. So I would 100% agree with that. Yeah, for sure. And there's some really nice kind of like fluid sounding parts to it that just sort of like sway like back and forth kind of thing that I really like with that track. But again, I do think it's a track that's on in the background, and there's nothing really there for me that kind of drags my ear in to listen, other than really maybe his vocal ad libs at the end, where he's like, "For me," right at the end, you know, all of that kind of stuff I quite like. But the rest of it sort of meanders. It's meandering, I think, that track.
So obviously, as you say, we flip the LP over, we get to side two, we're kicking off with Afraid of Love. So it's another Luke vocal. Yeah.
I love this track. The bass line for this track is it's saucy. It's really in there with the synth bass over the top of it as well. That sort of double tracked. I mean, who plays the synth on this? I'm going to have to Wikipedia this. Who is on this? Good Lord, there's a lot of people on this.
A lot of people, a lot of Beccaros as well.
Yeah, yeah. even Joe makes an appearance on this track.
Yeah, I think it's anyone who's like not really familiar with Toto and me just throwing out different names, different Beccaros, and going, is he getting the name wrong every time?
Yeah,
or what's going on?
Yeah. So listeners, just so we're clear, Joe Beccaro is the dad. Then there's Steve Beccaro, Mike Beccaro, and Jeff Beccaro. They're the brothers.
There we go. Yeah, we probably should have done that at the start.
Yeah, we should.
That was an important
an important moment, I think.
Yeah, exactly. So we're track six, Afraid of Love. Who is the synth player on track six? Come on. Is it? It's not Roger Lynn. No, that's track four. Marty Paich. That's David's dad, isn't it? Marty Paich. Mm. It's not credited on, well, at least not on Wikipedia.
Nice.
Well, there is a guy called Ralph Dick. Child. Maybe it's Steve Ficarra then. Maybe it's him doing it. But anyway, that double tracked bass synth and David Hungate playing the actual bass. Ah, oh, I love it. I have ripped off so many fills and so many things from David Hungate and Mike Porcaro. So sorry guys, but yeah.
I think for me, weirdly, and this might just be me, so feel free to just call me out if it is. But this in the verses, it has a real kind of Def Leppard feel to me, kind of that sort of chugging guitar thing that's going on. More in kind of, I mean, at this point, Def Leppard were in their early days. I think they just released High and Dry, so it's certainly not an attempt to emulate Def Leppard by any stretch, but I can definitely, for me, I can definitely hear this kind of Def Leppard vibe in Afraid of Love.
Mm. Yeah, I think so. Yeah, but just, I don't know if Joe Elliott's vocals would have gone too well sitting on top of that track.
No, maybe not. Maybe not.
I'd hear it, I'm open to it, but
I mean, thinking about how big the singles were on this album, you know, there's no doubt that some songs here could have been really strong singles on another album. So say if this was an 8-track album and we took 1 and 10 away, you know, I think this could have been a really strong single.
Yeah, I think it could have been.
And I think that's just testament, it is, again, and we say it time and time again, I think that's just testament to the depth and the musicianship on this album, that we're going through it and an album track like Afraid of Love would be like, yeah, that could have been a single.
I mean, I don't think anything off here. Well, okay, maybe It's a Feeling. Maybe that's not. I don't think that's maybe single material. But Good For You could have been Afraid of Love. Lovers in the Night, yeah. I think so. Yeah, I mean, I think my only one that maybe wouldn't personally, I wouldn't have chosen to be a single is It's a Feeling, yeah. But everything else is just like hit after hit, isn't it? Like,
yeah. I mean, you mentioned Lovers in the Night, so it seems like a good opportunity to jump over. Written solely by David Paich. This is our first song with him on lead vocals. Of course, he does pop up again on Africa. You shared before kind of your favourite Toto singers over the years, obviously saying that you think that Luke's kind of, for you, number one. Where does David rank amongst those Toto vocalists for you?
If I'm honest, I kind of forget that he does do lead vocals. I do forget because I think he's overshadowed quite a bit by the other guys. I don't know. I've seen them a few times live. And he always does like weird stuff on stage. He's always a bit weird. So I think he gets, I don't know why I think that, but yeah, just.
Like what? I want to know. I've not been lucky enough to see them, so.
Oh, I've seen them like 3 or 4 times. And,
okay.
And oh my God, one, I saw them at the Albert Hall and I was literally like sitting on the stage. It was the best thing ever. I was practically in Toto. It was amazing. He hides behind the piano and like, I don't know. It just weirds me out. It just freaks me out. But yeah, I sort of forget actually that he sings. I mean, you know, obviously he sings, but I do forget a little bit that he does do the lead vocals. And he did a lot on like Hydra as well, didn't he? Which maybe that's why I'm not a massive fan of that album, because I'm not a big fan of Paich's vocals, I don't think. Not massively, but if I hear it in moderation, it's great. But I think when he sort of goes in there as the sort of leading guy, I'm not overly a fan. Like, but then I'm not a massive fan of Kimball's vocals that much either. I do appreciate them. I think he's amazing on this album, but you know, when he had his hiatus from the band and came back and did, you know, tracks like Cruel and stuff like that, I thought his vocal again was excellent there. But I don't think he's, and I think the same of Paich, I don't think either of them are as consistent, perhaps vocally, as Luther Williams, Fredrickson, RIP. Yeah, I think that's kind of where I sit with David Paich's vocals, really. I think that he's not a singer, I don't think, like a vocalist. He's not like, in the same way that I think, I don't know, even that sounds weird to say though, like, because they're all so incredible, but it's like when you've got a load of people that are immensely talented and you're trying to compare them with being multi-talented bastards, like, I'd probably be quite happy with the fact that I was an amazing arranger and keyboard, piano player and keyboard player and not quite as good a vocalist. I'd probably be all right with that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Especially if I'd have played on that many albums.
Absolutely. I mean, it's certainly, we're talking about kind of the eclecticism of the album. It's certainly one of the rockier tracks on the album.
Yes.
Something Else reviews have a lot of praise for it. Within that, they call it one of the best total rockers ever.
Yes, I'd agree. Yeah, I think it's up there with like Girl Goodbye. I think it's up there with one of those kind of like straight up, like it's another one of those Toto driving rock tracks, isn't it? And I think, you know, it is up there 100%. It's such a good sort of like, you know, really kind of gets you pumping, that track, doesn't it? You know, it's great for sure.
I think maybe one of the reasons that you love it so much, one of the reasons that it is kind of so lauded, I think, is Steve Lukather's contributions to the track. And one of the other things that Something Else say is that he provides arguably his best group of solos on the album on this track. I mean, again, obviously you've said what an amazing guitarist he is, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I should basically just marry him, shouldn't I? I'm just like, shut up. Stop talking about Steve Lukather, God's sake.
To be fair, this is the forum to do it if you go into it, to be fair.
It's not often I get to talk about Toto with someone who is equally into Toto, so yeah, it doesn't happen often.
Yeah, but I mean, obviously, like I say, obviously, obviously, not within this conversation, but perhaps in the wider scope, grossly underrated as a guitarist. Do you think this is his kind of, you know, if someone was to say to you, all right, show me how good he is this the track you'd take them to?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Without question. The solos he's got in this are just, we're not worthy kind of vibes. You know, they're just, I think they really capture his prowess and his virtuosity on the instrument, 100%, yeah.
So we'll move on to We Made It. So Bobby's powerful vocals return on We Made It. And again, just with the nature of kind of the vocal changes and stuff, there's been quite a few songs. And as much as I love what's come before, it has been a while since we've heard his vocals.
Yeah.
I feel at this point they make a really welcome return. It feels like the perfect point. I mean, what are your thoughts on We Made It as we begin to approach the end of the album?
It's kind of a little bit of a similar one to It's a Feeling for me. It's kind of a bit of a sort of, it's in the background. It's a great track and the songwriting's amazing, obviously, of course, when you've got Paige and Jeff writing it. You're on to a winner, aren't you? Let's face it. But for me, it's not one of my favourites from the album. Although I do love Bobby's return after, like, especially after Lovers in the Night. It's just, I think there's quite a bit of a contrast between the two tracks. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether it's maybe its position on the album for me, just maybe could have been somewhere else. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, it's just one of those kind of background tracks again for me. If I was, you know, sitting listening to the record from start to finish, instead of skipping the track, I'd probably go and make a cup of tea during this one, you know.
I think it's a great example, like we said, that strength of multiple vocalists, because I guess the song's great. I'd argue perhaps, you know, if Bobby had sang the entire album from start to finish, this song might fade a little more into the background.
Yeah, it would.
But I think, like I said, because it's been maybe three or four tracks since he's been front and centre, I think it does stand out a little bit more because of that, maybe.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, personal preference, really, for this one, for me. I think in between Lovers in the Night and Waiting for Your Love, I kind of think it gets a bit lost. You know, I think maybe its positioning just maybe it could have been opening side two for me personally. Because again, you've still not really had much Bobby up to this point. So, I mean, maybe him coming back on this would have been a better position. I'm not sure.
I mean, as regular listeners will know, and as I'm sure you're aware by now, I do tons of research kind of ahead of these chats. There's actually not a lot out there about We Made It, which I do think is a shame. I can see what you're saying, but I think, you know, usually, you know, even if it's an album track, which you can find some kind of review or opinion
about
somewhere.
Yeah.
Not very little about We Made It. I think for me, you know, it's a bright song. I feel it does come in at the right time. We're powering towards the end of the album.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is? Do you think it's the reasons you've said? Do you think that's maybe why it's been overlooked? Because it clearly isn't the song that's talked about very much.
Maybe it's because after the intensity of Lovers in the Night, mm-hmm. which, you know, which got rave reviews, that track, and, you know, the instrumental abilities of everyone on it as well, I just think maybe it sort of takes a bit of a step back from that, and maybe it just kind of gets a bit overshadowed, just possibly because where it is positioned, maybe. I that would be why I would think that, just because of that powerful track before it. But you're always going to struggle with that, I think, on this album, because where could you put it? They're all powerful tracks. They're all, you know, it must have been a very difficult task organizing it into the order it's you know, that we know and love now.
Yeah, Yeah. And I mean, obviously, Waiting for Your Love, another great example, another Bobby vocal.
Now, I love this track. Yeah. I love this track.
So what is it you love about this track?
I love how I get it confused with Afraid of Love, because there's so many tracks about love. But again, I mentioned the bass line in Afraid of Love, and actually I meant for Waiting for Your Love. I love the bass line in this track. I love Bobby's ad-libs in the outro, where he's just kind of like really pushing it. You can hear in his vocal that he's really super pushing it. And it's, again, just, I think, just worth acknowledging Paich's work in producing that vocal take and really pushing Bobby to the point where he's, you know, barely able to sing it, but he gets it across the line, and it's right at, you know, it's 100%, and you can hear he's giving it 100%. And I think that's what I really love about this track, because there's a lot where, I mean, I don't know, maybe listeners will hate me for this as well, but I do think that Kimball does fall down quite a lot on vocal performance, especially maybe more so later on in his career, again, for various reasons, as we know. But I think, you know, he's being pushed to the absolute limit on this track, and you can hear he excels as the track finishes, and he's really pushing. And I think, you know, it's just, it all just comes together so wonderfully on here. And again, it's another, well, I think he co-wrote it as well, didn't he? So he's got that investment in it anyway. He's not just singing something that somebody else has written. He's got that investment. David Paich as well, bringing a little bit of that sort of 80s Michael Jackson funk a little bit. You know, it's not funk, is it? But soul, I suppose, but soul kind of that vibe. And I think that's really what he excels at, is this kind of style. So I can hear that for sure on this track. It's so well done. It's so well executed. And it's one of my favorites.
Yeah. I mean, Bobby talking about, obviously, like you say, he did co-write the track. He told Goldmine magazine he initially wrote Waiting for Your Love in the 70s when he initially called it You Got Me. There's not a huge songwriting contribution from Bobby on tour. I think there's only one other song where he has a songwriting credit.
Yeah.
Do you think this song stands out in that regard? Like you say, he's a bit more invested in it.
Yeah, I do.
Song. Yeah.
Yeah, I do. You can hear his investment. You know, I think, not that I was there or would begin to, you know, speculate, but I would, if it was me and I'd co-written this song, there'd be points where, you know, obviously you're in the studio, you know, the producer's pushing you to do your best takes and everything. And I think where, if it wasn't my song, I may be more prepared to give up earlier, you know, from singing and kind of giving it my all. But if I've co-written it and I'm invested in it, then I will go that little bit extra to get it across the line. And I think, you know, that's, I would say, arguably, this is probably Bobby's best track.
On the album or his career?
His career, I would say. I think this is probably, for me, arguably his best track.
So you mentioned that kind of Michael Jackson soul sound, which is really interesting. Obviously, we talked earlier about how they were working on Thriller while recording Total 4, and obviously they were released at around a similar time. On the record, note some similarities between the two albums here on Waiting for Your Love, noting the sonic similarities to Michael Jackson's Thriller, that they're obvious. One could easily mistake it for an outtake on Jackson's masterpiece. Would you agree with that? Like, if you put a Michael Jackson vocal on this, like, could it sit quite nicely on Thriller?
So. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's not the first time that they've done that either, I don't think. Like, I think it could fit quite happily on a Michael Jackson album, you know. And again, that just kind of goes to show the level that they are at. You know, that their songs are unmistakably theirs. But also it's such a talent to be able to put your song into the hands of somebody like Michael Jackson or, you know, or whoever, and end up with something that is then unmistakably a Michael Jackson song, you know.
Yeah.
What a talent that is, you know.
Yeah. And then we'll move on to our final track. We've talked about it little bits so far. One of my favorite songs of all time. I'm going to put it out there already. Yep. Currently the ringtone on my phone. Oh. My four-year-old daughter loves it. And we're going to end Total 4. Obviously with Africa. I'm just going to tell a personal story before we dive into this, which I think you'll enjoy. So as I say, I love the song loads. My four-year-old daughter, Ellie, she is starting to get into all the kind of music I like, and she loves Africa. Often if I'm picking her up from school or we're driving around, she'll ask to play it. And then obviously, as I said, it's my ringtone. So it was a couple of weeks ago now, we're driving along And Ellie says to me, "Daddy, Daddy, play Africa, play Africa." And I was like, "Okay, yeah, I'm not arguing with that.
Absolutely."
You know, "Hey Siri, play Africa." So it starts, and then she goes, "Daddy, your phone's ringing." So, but yeah, and you know, I mean, obviously, I've given you a bit of a taste of how much I think this is an absolute masterpiece. What are your thoughts on the song? Because I know that some people, idiots, but I know some people think it's a bit overplayed.
Idiots. They're idiots. I would listen to this song on a 3-hour loop all day if I could, you know. What can I say that hasn't already been said? It's a true masterpiece. Again, the bass fills that Hungate does, I've ripped off so many times. The whole build of the song, the whole arrangement, just, again, I mean, I think it could be the quintessential Toto track too, you know. It's just such an incredible composition, I think. And yes, it is overplayed. Yes, it is, you know, like, when you think of Toto, you think of Africa, you know. Mm-hmm. But I'm all right with that.
Yeah.
I'm fine with that, you know. It's another Paich and Picaro special, of course. Mm-hmm. The video is mental. I also absolutely did not recognise David Paich in the video when I first saw it either. He's had quite a bit of scaffolding up, hasn't he? Bless his heart. And I didn't recognise him to begin with. And also the video features Mike Picaro. So the video was obviously filmed way after the album was done. So...
Mm. Yeah. I mean, David Paich spoke to Mix Online about the song and the inspiration for it. So he said, "Over many years, I'd been taken by the UNICEF ads with the pictures of Africa and the starving children. I'd always wanted to do something to connect with that and bring more attention to the continent. I wanted to go there too." So when he'd written this song, he'd never actually been to Africa. "I sort of invented a song that put me in Africa. I was hearing the melody in my head. I sat down and played the music in about 10 minutes. Then the chorus came out. I sang the chorus out as you hear it. It was like God channeling it. I thought, I'm talented, but I'm not that talented. Something just happened here." And I think, you know, obviously, I'm trying to work out here in terms of episodes of My Classic Album, we're approaching episode 60 with this one. And this seems to be a common thing that some of these really iconic songs, what makes them so special, what makes them so great, it wasn't about kind of pouring over it for hours and hours. It just kind of comes to people, like the riff for Sweet Child of Mine, how Slash was just kind of messing around with his guitar, like, and Africa just seems to be another example of that it just sort of,
yeah,
divine intervention, if you like.
Yeah, absolutely. And just before I start this anecdote, just caveat, I am not comparing the Hot Damn to the excellence of Toto or you know, or anyone like that, but I mean, we're talented, but we're not that talented, just to quote. We had a similar experience with our latest single, I Didn't Like You Anyway. It sort of fell out, you know, fell onto the page, fell out of our fingers kind of thing. I mean, Jill wrote the song, and just when it came to sort of getting it to sound how we wanted it in the rehearsal room, it didn't take a lot of effort. It was just suddenly there, you know, whereas our previous single had a lot of intricate parts to it, had a lot of vocals that were quite difficult to get down. It took a lot longer. But, you know, in the case of I Didn't Like You Anyway, it really did sort of it. We just played it once through and we were like, oh, that sounds all right. You know, so in our very sort of minuscule way of being able to relate to something like that, it does kind of happen. I mean, I do wish that, you know, we'd have suddenly written Africa, because you know, we'd probably be quite a lot richer than we are. But here's hoping that I Didn't Like You Anyway makes us millions of pounds.
Yeah, fingers crossed. I mean, I think for me, Africa, it as I said, it's the ultimate example, I think, of what makes them great. You know, yeah. It's so catchy,
yeah.
But there's so much, like, so if you're just listening to it casually, as I'm sure many, many people are, you know, it's just a great song, it's catchy, but there's so much going on
underneath
the surface. And,
yeah,
you know, Paich continued in that interview, he said, "Jeff got out African sticks, bottle caps that his dad used on National Geographic films.
Yeah.
He brought in a marimba, a wooden xylophone, your hearing-based marimba, that other instrument, and you're probably hearing one of the first loops that was ever done." So that's what he says. So do you think, obviously, it's, and we'll talk about this a bit more in a minute, it's so ingrained in pop culture, this song.
Yeah.
It is easy to forget just how much is going on in this song.
Yeah, I think so. I think it is quite easy. And also, unless I think you're listening for it, you could just be, I think you could be forgiven for thinking that it just sort of, you know, it's just sort of like a keyboard or something like that, you know, or like, you know, some loop that you've set up in Logic or whatever, you know, obviously predating that, but it's, yeah. There's so much going on. There's so much intricacy to that track. You know, there's, well, I mean, just having a look at the personnel list.
Yeah.
You know, we've got Paige Kimball, Luther Beccaro, Hungate and Jeff Beccaro. We've got Lenny Castro, who does the conga shakers and additional percussion, Timothy B. Schmidt. There's a 12-string acoustic guitar. I mean, where did that come from? I don't think I've even heard that. Like, I need to listen to that again. Recorders? Where are they? And, you know, Joe Beccaro again on percussion and marimba. So Lenny Castro and Joe Beccaro doing that, you know. So there's two people for percussion. Like, and I need to figure out where those acoustic guitars and recorders are coming from because I don't remember that.
You said Mike Picaro's in the video, but obviously he's not on the track.
Yes.
So Africa was actually released 10 months after the release of Total Recall.
Yes, fair enough.
So that might have been why. Reach number one in the US probably helped them shift a few million more copies of the album.
Oh, yeah.
Steve Lukather told Ultimate Classic Rock he was surprised at the song's success. He said, "I never thought Africa was going to be a hit. I didn't think it made any sense at all. It's a great record, but to this day, I don't know what the lyrics mean, and it was such an oddball piece of music. Now it's like herpes. There's an outbreak every year." Which, he's totally right. Just when you think that there'll be something, you know, obviously it's been on things like Family Guy, like it's memes, it's, you know, just when you think it's dying down, something else happens where Africa kind of comes back to the surface. You know, do you think, obviously, and this is a difficult question to ask because it's so ingrained in everywhere, do you think that it was a strange or maybe even a risky choice for a single?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Because it's not heavily guitar driven. It's not, I mean, it's kind of really like percussion led, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's stuck on the end of the album too. And it's a bizarre choice. I genuinely don't know why it does keep coming back. I mean, I'm perfectly loving the fact that it does, don't get me wrong. Yeah. Like, but I'm just thinking to myself, how? Like, who likes this? Like, I've got a weird taste in music. Like, I know that I like it. And I know that, you know, it's like Toto are a musician's band. So, you know, everyone likes Toto that's a musician, surely. But like normal people, like where is this coming from? Like, I can say is they must have a really, really good PR agent.
but again, it must just keep going in the fact that, you know, I told that story at the beginning, you know, my daughter's 4 years old and she loves this song, you know, and it's a 40-year-old song.
Yeah. There was also something that I don't think even Lukather believes it, does he? Because he says, what did he say? He said, if this song is a hit, I'll run naked down Sunset Strip or Hollywood Boulevard or something like that, didn't he? I mean, I don't think he's ever done that, but he should do. Like, promise is a promise.
I mean, to give this is probably the best example of how enduring this song is and will continue to be. In 2015, Nambian artist Max Seidentopf set up a sound installation in the middle of the Nambian desert that's going to play Africa forever and ever, thanks to the joy of solar batteries. So he hopes his art installation will keep Toto going for all eternity, in his words.
I want to know what the PRS is on that.
You know, I think, you know, it's like, you know, we live in a world of, you know, war, global warming, global pandemic, you know, to make this a little bit topical for people who are listening years later, prime ministers having parties when we're all in lockdown, all these horrible things. But there's something comforting to know that kind of before and after all of that, Africa is just going to keep playing forever in the Nambian desert.
Yeah, I know. I'm actually thinking about moving there personally, just so I can hear my favourite song for all of eternity.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, to bring it back to the context of Total 4, how does Africa end the album for you?
I think it's a perfect album ender. You know, I think it's got that really long outro that they do live, don't they? They one by one, they stop playing until it's just drums and percussion, I think. And I think that sums it up nicely. It's sort of a departure, isn't it? It's like we've had a little bit of everything. Now we've got this batshit crazy track that's finishing the album that is unlike anything else that they've ever written, I think, at that point. And certainly polar opposites from everything else on the album. And it's sat there quite nicely at the end. And it just fades out one by one. I think it's a perfect ender. It's sort of the opposite of Rosanna, because Rosanna starts with the drums and then Africa ends with the drums. So it's kind of like a mirror image, sorry, not opposite. It's like a mirror image of an album, isn't it? I think. So I think it's a very good, smart choice. But batshit crazy.
Yeah. So 40 years old this year. Total Four manages to sound timeless, yet a product of its time all at once. The critics might have been merciless with them at times, but the songs on this album, as we've talked about, they continue to permeate pop culture, creating new generations of fans of the band. Ultimate classic rock sum up the album's impact really nicely. All told, Total Four would prove to be an all but impossible act to follow for the group, at least in terms of their sales, which dwindled in the US with subsequent releases. But through decades of changes on the charts and in the band, they've remained in demand around the world. With the exception of a brief breakup, they've stayed creatively active all along. Unlike some bands whose biggest hits become an albatross, the members of Toto remain justifiably proud of what they accomplished with this album. With that in mind, you know, why do you think this album has stood the test of time?
I mean, pretty much exactly what the critics are saying about it. I mean, it I think you sum it up really well when you say it manages to sound timeless whilst also sounding like a product of its time. It's also showcasing the virtuosity of the players, and the arrangements and then the songwriting. It also took risks. It didn't sound like anything else at the time. It was totally unique. And I think, you know, there's not really an awful lot at the time really that kind of sounds anything like it in the rock scene. And there were also obviously a load of like massively successful albums that came out of the same kind of era. But I think for me, this one stands up there with all of them. It's just an incredible achievement from a playing point of view, as I said, from a songwriting point of view, from a production point of view, you know, throwing everything at it. You know, you couldn't play that album on you could play that album on an acoustic guitar and it would still sound great.
And finally, you know, why is Total Four your classic album, and why should people check it out if they haven't already?
Total Four is my classic album because I think there's something for everyone on it. I think there's the sort of groovy like soul tracks. There's the balls out rock and roll tracks. There's the humor tracks as well. There's light-hearted tracks in there. I think you could really kind of have any, you could be in any mood and listen to that album. And if you weren't really, you know, feeling one way or the other, and you just wanted to appreciate some excellent musicianship and creativity and songwriting, there's that on there as well. So I just think there really is, there's something for everyone, be it whether you're a musician or just an aficionado. I think, you know, you could, anyone can take something from it.
Well, Lizzie, thanks so much for joining us, and thank you for picking a Total album. As I said at the start, it's been awesome.
And we're not moving on to Isolation now, are we?
we'll sort that out for next time. But no, I mean, obviously we've talked a bit about the Hot Damn, haven't we? And you know, obviously it sounds like things are on the up, which is really exciting. What are your plans for 2022 and what's going to be going on?
Well, we've got a small run of shows at the end of February with our absolute heroes, These Wicked Rivers. So we're doing like a run of four shows, and then we are both playing at Planet Rock Winter's End on the 4th and 5th of March. The Hot Damn are on the 4th, Rivers are on the 5th. After that, we are doing some serious songwriting because we will be doing the album this year, and then hopefully a tour to support that subsequently. So can't say too much about it at the minute, but we'll be finalizing certain details and bits and pieces, and you know, we'll obviously be shouting from the rooftops later on in the year about that. But yeah, so the main interim points are just now doing a little run of shows, having a laugh, getting our music out to some new faces. We do refer to our band as the touring hen do. We basically just cause destruction wherever we go, basically. I don't know how this happens. But yeah, so we're going to bring our very glitter and tie-dye fueled destruction to Planet Rock Winter's End in March. So we're on the 4th. These Wicked Rivers are on the 5th.
What an opportunity to talk about an amazing band in total. You know, everything's just pitch perfect. Like, Africa, and I don't care what anyone says, is a perfect song. And, you know, even songs that I love, I can find something where I'll be like, oh, well, it'd be cool if there was this, or it'd be cool if there was that. Like, for me, Africa is easily in, like, my top five songs of all time. Absolute thrill to be able to chat with Lizzie Hayes all about Toto, all about Toto 4, just the band in general, really, you know. But again, that's what My Classic Album's all about. You heard the latest single from The Hot Damn, I Didn't Like You Anyway. That's out now. Obviously, she's kind of filled you in as well on where you can catch them over the coming months and what the plan is for the band. Absolutely keep an eye out on them, because I've got a feeling there just seems to be a lot of the people that we're getting on lately and will continue to get on. So people like Jack J. Hutchinson, The Hot Damn, Troy Redfern, Sons of Liberty. You know, there just seems to be this real kind of swell of British rock. This kind of wave of British rock. I know people talk about the new wave of classic rock, and they talk about that internationally, but I think particularly the British scene, there's just something going on at the moment, you know, in a way that it's not been going on in the time I've been doing My Classic Album. Some really, really great bands and singers on the rise. I'll try and get as many of them as I can on the show for you. Just keep an eye out for The Hot Damn, because I've got a feeling they're going to be big. But that'll do it. Another episode of My Classic Album. Where does the time go? But don't worry, because in 2 weeks' time, we're going to be having another one. So we're going to jump back a little bit. Toto to Lynyrd Skynyrd. That's not the most outrageous jump we've made so far in season 4, so I'll take it. We're going to be looking at their debut album, Pronounced Lynyrd Skynyrd, with Fred Hale and Andy Moose Muse of Sons of Liberty. So that's coming up in 2 weeks' time. Until then, I've been Mike Norris, and I'll see you soon. Cheers.